Since it's the Patronal Festival, I thought I would talk about a couple of intriguing topics that have arisen in my preliminary research into the parish history. I want to emphasise it's early days yet, but you know, the way I'm approaching it is it's like a detective story, and as you set out to answer these intriguing mysteries, it's got the added interest that this is our story. And I want to talk about two things in the period that's particularly interesting right now, which is the period just after the Great War and the 1920s, a very turbulent time in the history of this parish, but a very creative time also. And I want to begin by talking about the great Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918. Very puzzled I was that in the vestry minutes there's no reference to one of the most traumatic incidents in New Zealand's history. So I got Geoffrey Rice's recent and famous book on the subject and began reading. And it told me how Canon Brian King, you know, the vicar here from the 1890s who Catholicised the parish, was asked by Dr. Farris, the chief medical officer, to head up the relief effort in Dunedin. And I thought, well, what an inspiring story to tell the parishioners. And then I thought, this is odd. Flicking through my notes, Canon Brian King had died in retirement in 1915, so how could he have risen from the dead to carry out this remarkable task? And so, digging deeper, I found out that it was his son, in fact, Vincent Brian King, who was the person being referred to here. Remarkable that a professional historian has made a mistake like this. Now, Vincent King became the great social worker priest of this diocese in the interwar years. He rejoiced under the title of, where are we now? Visitor to public institutions, which meant he was supposed to be looking after those in the hospital, the prison, the law courts, the benevolent institution, I think that was a kind of early 20th century version of the workhouse, and the industrial school. Now, he was a very familiar figure in Dunedin, known as an efficient organiser. He was president of the Red Cross and the St John's Ambulance Society, and on the basis of this, Dr. Farris asked him to organise the relief effort. And so Vincent King took over the old Red Cross shop in the middle of town and organised the relief effort from there. So when the Prime Minister's telegram arrived, telling all cities in New Zealand to get themselves properly organised because an efficient relief effort was key to bringing the losses down, Dunedin had already done that. And in fact, Dunedin's casualty toll was half that of Christchurch. It was considerably lower than many other parts of New Zealand. And you know, what had made the great flu epidemic really scary is that it broke out in quite a number of countries at the same time. It advanced very rapidly and left very rapidly. And whereas viral epidemics usually kill the very old, the very young, and the very ill, this was different. It killed active, fit young adults, which chief victims. And the problem was that they didn't know what to do. They knew that bed rest was a good idea, they knew that bringing your temperature down was a good idea, and they knew that giving you lots of fluids was a good idea, but otherwise they didn't have antibiotics, and if it turned to pneumonia, that was the finish of you usually. And what scared people even more was that when people died of pneumonia, their skin turned blue or black. Apparently this is because pneumonia really kills you by a kind of oxygen deprivation. You know, the capillaries in the skin were oxygen deprived. So Dunedin actually got off comparatively lightly. There were the bad places to be in New Zealand were Auckland, the Waikato, Southland, certain isolated settlements like Denniston, the coal mining town. And it particularly affected badly Māori, who were usually living in rural communities then, who of course hadn't been exposed to many of the viruses that people living in cities had. And for that reason, we're not entirely sure how many people died in New Zealand. We think somewhere between 8,000 to 12,000 people, and it all happened in the space of about a month. So Vincent Brian King was the hero of the day. Dr. Farris just bypassed the mayor and the councillors. They came down with the flu anyway. And really, Dunedin was ruled for a month by three people: the hospital superintendent, the chief medical officer, and Vincent King. And you know, Vincent King founded the Mission for Men in a dilapidated house in Filial Street. In effect, Dunedin had a city mission running right through the interwar years, and that positioned it very well for when the Great Depression began. And you may recall that during the 150th celebrations, David Hoskins had found a newspaper reference to Vincent King, who talked about the fact that his knowledge of jiu-jitsu was very helpful when he was visiting the opium dens in Rattray Street. So clearly a remarkable person who worked extremely hard. He had a major health breakdown in 1922, another one in 1939. He retired in 1943, and the Mission House closed then for lack of demand, and he died soon afterwards in 1945. Well, the people of Dunedin were so impressed with what he'd done that they gave him a cheque for £1,000, a new motor car, and recommended him for the OBE, which he received. Now, £1,000 was a lot of money in those days, and it was all raised by public subscription. I want to talk now about the great bust-up that occurred at St. Peter the Less in 1930. Now, in the early 1920s, the formidable matriarchs of St. Clair got together and decided they wanted a local Anglican church in their vicinity, and they presented the vestry of this parish with a petition of 130 signatures requesting that. That was okay, but they also requested that the parish boundaries be changed because they wanted the new church to be within the newly created parish of Holy Cross St Kilda. Oh dear, the vestry at St Peter's wasn't very impressed with that, and counter-petitioned Synod to stop it. And so the history of this new church got off to, well, one of the themes I've got to explore is why the relationship between Holy Cross, St Kilda and this parish has been so ambivalent through its history, despite the fact that two of its vicars, both Father Teal and the vicar who was here through the 50s, and then Alan Jackery, who was a son of this parish, became a vicar. Despite all that, it's often been quite a tense relationship, and maybe this is the spark of it all. How dare that upstart parish we just gave its independence to in 1917 presume to absorb the most wealthy part of our parish? Well, by 1927, St Peter's, which had gone through a turbulent period of losing vicars rapidly in the early 1920s, had Canon Button as his vicar from 1925 to 1935. Was a more stable period. The matriarchs of St Clair had raised a great deal of money, and so a plot of land was purchased in Hodges Crescent, and they then proceeded to buy the old Catholic Apostolic Church that I think was in McLagan Street. Now, I think that's the altar on there from the old St. Peter the Less, and it was originally in the Catholic Apostolic Church, which was a remarkable Christian group. It had been founded in the early 19th century by the Reverend Irving, hence their name Irvingites, and they were really proto-Pentecostals. They believed in ecstatic things like praying in tongues, also quite high church, and they were into mystical names and titles. And they believed, as churches with ecstatic consciousness often do, in the imminent return of our Lord Jesus Christ in their lifetime. So these apostles were ordained, the only people who could ordain people, and they weren't replaced after Irving died. The last apostle died in 1901, and so the church just died out because Jesus didn't return in their lifetime. And so the people of St. Peter the Less, as it came to be called, bought the church lock, stock and barrel and its furniture and moved it into position in 1928 in Hodges Crescent. And what happened then was that a retired priest from Timaru, the Reverend J.H. Rogers, became kind of the guy who took the Sunday services, the occasional offices, and he was in an ideal situation because they didn't have to pay him a full-time stipend. And Canon Button greeted this new development with great gratitude. He only had to go to St. Peter the Less once a month. And all was sweetness and light for two or three years until 1930. And what seems to have happened, reading between the lines, is that the people of St. Peter the Less wanted to assert an increasing independence from St. Peter's. And Canon Button decided to bring an abrupt end to this. He made it clear that St. Peter the Less would only be for what he called it, the worship of the very young and the very old. He arranged for the Reverend J.H. Rogers' employment to be terminated, and he brought in a curate supplied by the diocese, the Reverend Samuda. Well, the people of St Peter the Less were very unimpressed with this. Three members of the vestry of this parish resigned. They'd been from St Peter the Less. The Ladies' Guild dissolved itself. That was significant because they were the big fundraisers from the St Clair matriarchs. And a number of people left the church at St Peter the Less. It was a very difficult time. And to some extent, Canon Button was then hoist with his own petard because the Depression hit. The curate, the Reverend Samuda, had to be moved on to Invercargill. Canon Button had to take a pay cut, and he had to struggle on for the next 5 years trying to look after the parish on his own. A constant theme of vicars in those days was, there's too much visiting to do, I need help. And Button left in 35, his health not in great shape, and went to Waikawiti to recoup and to kind of have a gradual retirement, he thought. Well, Waikawiti was so restful, he in fact became the Dean of the Cathedral and presided over it through the war years. And really the healing process didn't begin until 1935 when Arthur Pywell, that peppery little Australian, became the vicar here. He wasn't afraid of the St Clair matriarchs. He looked them in the eye and told it like it was. And when the war came, he said, look, we've got to overcome this tension and conflict, and we're all going to start rowing in the same direction. And in a sense, he was the most effective handler of that end of the parish. The other vicars, Anne Turvey, who wrote the history of St Peter the Less, felt was rather apprehensive about these powerful women. And you know, the 50s and 60s were a great time for St Peter the Less. With Anne Turvey, they had a Thursday school for kids after school, which was in a kind of a Sunday school on Thursday, and a youth group. It was really cooking with gas now. The formidable matriarchs were raising money. There was an outreach to young people. And there's an intriguing thought here, and it's one that Anne Turvey presented to David Sklar and me when we were interviewing her. Supposing, instead of opposing the development or the desire of the people of St Clair for their own church, this parish had gradually, you know, encouraged their evolving independence to the point where they had become the independent Anglican parish of St Clair. Certainly the sociology would have favoured the Anglican Church, and maybe that Anglican parish of St Clair would exist today. Or what might have been of history. I'll leave it there.